Okay, so today I'm going to talk about Randy is a devoted scientist, an inspirational leader, a respected colleague and friend, and I'm going to focus on his contributions to insect resistance management. Now, we have common paths. Randy was 6.5 months older than me. We both grew up in Indiana. I was in Greensburg and he was in Danville, about 72 miles apart. He graduated in 1972 from high school, and I graduated in 1973. He was born in Greencastle, Indiana, but I went to college in Greencastle, Indiana. And of course, he was up in West Lafayette. That's the home of Purdue University. And if you grow up in Indiana, you're either a Purdue fan or you're an IU fan. And obviously, Randy was a Purdue fan. But also, Ames was a common path for us because I'm in Ames right now. That's where I make my home, my family. We raised our daughter there. And of course, half the stories that we've heard here have took place in Ames or near Ames. So, like I said, it was an honor to know Randy. And I got a letter January 31st, 2006 from the provost of Kansas State asked me to write a support letter because he was being nominated for the preeminent position of University Distinguished Professor. And this position is reserved for a small group of faculty and that have continuous and truly outstanding record of scholarship recognized nationally and around the world. And I think there wasn't any doubt that Randy certainly satisfied all the requirements for this. And they gave me a electronic copy of the CV, and this thing was incredible. 45 pages, small print. And then I realized how much work he really did, because the work that I was associated with him was just three lines out of this 45-page CV. So then I was beginning to wonder if he ever slept, and that he just worked all the time. But today I want to be talking about the research committees, these three lines that were in this CV. And he was a member of NC 502, the Rapid Response Committee for Soybean Aphid, S1010, the Dynamic Soybean Pest Management for Evolving Agricultural Technologies and Cropping Systems. I don't know very much about his activities with those committees, but if there's anything like his contributions to NC205, they were fantastic. NC205 is the Ecology and Management of European Corn Borer and Other Stalk-Borne Lepidoptera. Now, I'm just going to give a little bit of history about corn research and the importance of corn so that you soybean people can be educated. But the regional research committee actually started back in NC20, Factors Influencing Corn Borer Populations, in 1954, coincidentally the year that the Randy was born. And then NC87 in 1966, NC105, 1971. Chuck, you probably know about all these. You go back that far. And then NC205 in 1985. Now, just to give you a little bit of an idea about the corn borer. Now, all these pictures were taken by Marlon Rice, of course, as a friend and one of Randy's students. And you see these photos peppered all over the meeting. But this is kind of a unique a photo. And these are some photos that we had slides. This goes all the way back to 1919. It's one of the earliest known photos I know of European corn borer in the United States. In fact, back then they called them maggots, European corn borer maggots. This was taken in Arlington, Massachusetts. So it wasn't too far after they were introduced, too long after they introduced the United States. Of course, this gives you an idea of some of the damage. They even did lineups on the corn back then. And this gives you another idea of just how much of an impact corn borer had, where back in the early days they tried to scrape up all the corn and residues and burn it. When I first came to Iowa State, Arno Hallar, who's a distinguished corn breeder, he had some plots at a farm demonstration area where he showed all the different corns from different decades, 1920s, 1930s, 40s, 50s, and all the way up into the 1990s at that time. And anything that was prior to 1940 was just melted down because European Corn War had such a devastating impact about that. And sometimes we forget how important European Corn War and how it devastated corn as it went through the various states. And when it went through Iowa in the 1940s, it was very, very devastating. And for those of you who are corn boar fans, I guess that's the best way to say it, is everybody's heard of Caffrey. And this is a picture actually taken by Caffrey in 1924, in May 24th, 1926. Now, the reason I'm showing this is that, Caffrey was a legend in European corn boar research, and I think in many ways that Randy's also a legend, and this is kind of a little bit of a tribute to him. And the corn boar committee chairs, the first one was Fred Holloway, University of Minnesota, 1954. Huey Chang, again from Minnesota, 1965. Armin Keister, Bill Showers, USDA-ARS, 1975. John Witkowski, these are the who in the corn boar group. Mark Scriber, Chuck Mason, who's sitting right over there, 1999, University of Delaware. Mike Weiss. And then Randy Higgins, Kansas State, 1998, myself after that, and now Dennis Calvin. But I want to focus on the time that Randy was there, because between 1995 and 2000, this was a critical period for BT corn and insect resistance management. And I can tell you that IRM today in corn wouldn't be what it is if it wasn't for Randy's contributions. So the big challenges with BT crops have been non-target organisms, gene flow and outcrossing, pollen flow, especially in areas where there may be organic producers, but also insect resistance management. And as the selection for resistance is a problem and requires management strategies. And the current strategy that we use is a high-dose refuge strategy. And this this little logo, I think Randy was involved with trying to get that made up. And this was such this was a concept that was kind of foreign to everybody, because actually we wanted to have corn produce corn borers, and trying to convince growers to allow corn borers to stay in that corn was kind of didn't make much sense. And how were we going to communicate that information to the growers? So Randy and I talked about that a lot, because we all the time that we spent together. But this just gives you a little idea of what the theory is. I'm sure most of you already know about this. But the idea is that you get in BT corn, there may be a few resistant moths. And of course, Randy did and his students did some work with BT resistance. And the idea is you're going to be producing thousands or hundreds of thousands, millions of these in the refuge corn. And it's essentially, and most of these are going to be susceptible. And the idea is that they're going to mate, and these are going to just wash out the resistant ones. But the key is you want to make sure you kill all the heterozygotes, those with one copy. So this is the sort of the foundation for insect resistance management with European corn borer that continues today. And we had a lot of NC205 insect resistance management activities, and this is just all the list of from 1995 to March 1999. And Randy participated in all of these, and in most cases he helped organize these. And so he had a critical impact here. Through the NC205, Bill Hutchison and Ken Osley We had this NC 205 IRM recommendations that we made for the BT corn and European corn borer, long-term success through resistance management. Now, we spent a lot of time going through this and thinking about it and debating back and forth and trying to put as much science underneath behind this as we could. And at a time that was very early on in this process, when in some cases, to be honest with you, we didn't really have enough science. But we said in there, we support the high-dose refuge strategy, and we understood that the primary refuge would be non-BT corn, and the refuge should be between about 20-30% or higher. And then in the high spray areas, that the refuge would be about 40% or higher, and that it should be within the same section, or that the refuge corn should be planted within a mile, half mile of the BT corn. So in 1998, we had these recommendations. Industry had their own recommendations, and it ranged anywhere from 5%, 10%, 20%, depending on which company it was. So it was a little confusing out there. The Union of Concerned Scientists and others were saying 40% or more, and the EPA gave the gene suppliers a deadline for when they had to come up with an insect resistance approach, and that was April 1st, 2001. So we were kind of under the gun to really deliver in this case. So just to give you an idea of what this means is that in some cases they wanted high refuge requirements, they wanted to be mandated. In other cases they wanted to be lower, and they wanted to be voluntary. Of course, the academics would always say, you know, more is better. And the regulators were kind of in between, but the main point is that the producers were confused because they were getting different information from all these different people. And this is one thing that Randy always pointed out, and I think that just from what I've heard is that he was always like this, is it practical? You know, the growers are the ultimate stewards of the technology, so the education is essential, and simple is better than complex. And we have to consider the grower realities at the same time without compromising the scientific integrity of insect resistance management. So I think that shows you where Randy was. Is he was always sort of in the balance there. Well, this is what the growers can do, this is what the science says, you know, we have to make it work. And that's where he was really a master. So all those meetings that I just told you about, I just want to focus on one, and there's several that I could have picked. But there was a special NC 205 meeting, September 24th and 25th, 1998 in Kansas City. And Chuck, you probably remember it. Tom, I don't know if you were there. Bill, I don't know if you might have been there. But the objectives of that meeting were to reconsider the refuge recommendations that were stated in the NCR 602 publication, and to amend the publication if possible, and provide this information to the EPA so that they could have the best science, so that when they made their recommendations for insect resistance management, that they would be prepared to do that. So the outcome is that in the summary, we this is taken directly from the minutes. It was really fun for me to go through and find all the old minutes and all of the notes that I got from Randy. And you know how when you go through these old treasure chests and you find, you know, a birthday card sent to you by your grandmother who's long gone, and you say, like, "Well, wow, that's really something." But that's how it was for me, because I was going through here and I was finding these letters from Randy, you know, handwritten to me, and it was really special. But anyway, that's the research I was doing, and I came across these things. But in summary, we find that scientific evidence leads us to reaffirm our 1997 recommendations. And as additional information becomes available, we will continue to reassess these recommendations. So, and this is like what you were saying, the modern extension person. You know, we bring the best science forward that we can, but at the same time, we're always working to improve it. So, a couple days later, and this was really pretty dramatic, because We had a representative from the National Corn Growers who was at that meeting, who was trying to pressure us by saying, well, we have all these publications that are going to be coming out, and they were trying to influence us to deviate from what we considered at the time to be the best science. So they wrote a letter and said, we are writing to urge you to ensure that sound science continues to prevail in the EPA decision-making process. This is an industry letter to the EPA, 2 days after we had our meeting. And essentially, they wanted a smaller refuge. And there was 46 organizations that signed this letter, and they copied it to Vice President Albert Gore, USDA Secretary Dan Glickman, and of course, the Lynn Goldman and Janet Anderson from the EPA. It's just given all the political things that have happened since then, it's kind of interesting to know that Albert Gore was actually involved with this to a certain extent. I also often wondered if he read that letter. but when it came to the USDA decision, the person that actually was at the level to make the decision was Deputy Secretary Richard Rominger. And when he the bottom line was, he said, he referred to the NC 205 publication regarding decision to keep the refuge at 20-30%. So that was where our research and all the work that we put into it actually had an impact in determining what the policy was going to be. And we were always told, we do the research, we bring that information to the policymakers, and then they make the decisions. We were always very careful to not cross that line between policy and science. And Randy was one of the people that, and he and Eldon Ortman, that really made it important for us, or told us that we shouldn't do that. So the current U.S. recommendation is the 20% refuge, and the proximity is it should be within a quarter mile, and it must be within a half mile, and with the corn rootworm now, it must be adjacent. So the essential contributors to this were the NC 205 members. We had modelers from three states, economists from four states, extension people from almost all the states in the biology. And Eldon Ortman, who was our administrative advisor at the time, did an excellent job of keeping us in line. And the one other thing I want to say about Randy is that we would go to these meetings, and we were under a lot of pressure to by the National Corn Grower or the industry representatives. And Randy and I had this really good ability to look at each other and know when the other person needed help. Okay, so I would start off saying something. You know how when you're saying something, sometimes you get a little off track and you get a little confused? Well, Randy would be there, and he would just take over. It was just like we were like one person, you know, and then the same thing would happen to me. Randy would go on, and he'd be talking about that, and then he'd look at me, and I could just tell from the look that he'd give me that it was time for me to say something. So we had a really good relationship there. So and I guess in some ways, you know, it was kind of like a brother, but certainly a good colleague. Also, essential contributors to this were the Charlene Madden, Doug Summerford, and Doug Sutherland, and Alan Reynolds from the EPA. So I can honestly say that if it wasn't for these contributions right here, and Randy was a critical component of this, that the insect resistant management recommendations wouldn't be what they are right now. And of course, the gene suppliers did participate in this process and were at all the meetings. Now, if we look at what's going on right now, BT corn has become very successful, and the BT maize is now the penetration is 50% or more, depending on where you are. And now that we have rootworm corn, it's becoming even a more valuable product for the corn growers. And I've heard other people talk about this too, but now that we have the stacks, where we have BT maize for corn borers, BT maize for rootworms, we have the herbicide tolerance plants, that now the penetration of genetically modified plants is approaching 80%. And it's likely it's going to be keep going up higher. So in addition to the impact that this has had in the United States, now the BT corn is being planted all over the world, other stock borers, and again, in most cases, the insect resistance management plans that are following these are very similar to what we have. We developed at NC205. And of course, the root feeders, the ear feeders, all these have their own resistance management considerations they have to make, and the armyworm. But now that we can see that there are examples where resistance is occurring in the field, the fall armyworm, Cry1F resistance at maize in Puerto Rico, African maize stem borer, Cry1AB maize resistance in South Africa, and the corn earworm, Cry1AC and cotton in the United States. So it's very important that we keep going with the insect resistance management. But the current challenges are that the current types of BT maize are not high dose for some insects. And the best example of that are the Diabronica species, the rootworms, and also for the armyworm and the corn earworm and many other pests in the family Noctuidae. So, and refuge compliance is increasingly more difficult. And I know I've talked with a lot of people, and there's anecdotal reports out there that that growers are starting not to plant refuge, and that noncompliance occurs increasingly a higher rate. And this is a problem. But at the same time, you know, it's the economic expense for the growers is a problem. And the complexity of planning and implementing the refuge is more difficult. And this shows you some of the BT corn penetration. In 2002, you know, in some places it was, 40 to 50%. But in 2006, we can see that already it's above 75% in certain areas of Minnesota, South Dakota, and Iowa. So now we have the multiple toxin maize, and it's almost as if we need to have these meetings again to reconsider insect resistance management. And like Randy was saying, you know, as new information becomes available, you know, we'll reassess things. And we're at that time right now, where we really do need to get our science together and reevaluate things, because we have multiple toxin maize. And we have pyramided genes where we have toxin A and toxin B with different modes of action. And you put these together and you get what they call a double kill. And when you have something like that, if there's a little or no potential for cross resistance, that you may have different new considerations for refuge. So we could have reduced refuge amounts, 10% or lower. At some point, we may be able to rely on native hosts, depending on what the insect is. And then we probably need to reevaluate seed mixtures. Now these are all questions that I'm thinking, well, wow, we really need Randy now, because you know he helped us so much before. And so Randy's leadership is missed. And as often I catch myself saying, you know, what would Randy have said? And everybody knows how passionate he was, how practical he was, and he always, like I said, considered the growers' needs, and he balanced us better than anybody that I've ever known in the sciences. So I want to just talk about one more thing. Randy and I both went to a meeting, and this was a resistance management meeting that was held in Washington D.C. over September 10th to the 11th, 2001. And this is where the meeting was. The EPA meeting site was here, and the Pentagon is right up there. That day, we were in the room listening to things, and all of a sudden we felt the windows vibrate, and we didn't know what it was. I guess that was probably about 9:37, maybe 9:38 by the time the waves would have gotten to us. And I always knew that we were close to the Pentagon at that time, but I didn't realize how close we were. So I went and did a little bit of research on, it's amazing what you can do with Google and MapQuest and all these things. And I found out that the American Airlines Flight 77, before crashing into the Pentagon, that its approach was like this. And you can see that this is where we were at the EPA meeting. Probably if we would have looked outside, we probably would have seen that plane going by. Now, after the crash, it took a little bit of time after that. I remember I went outside and I saw people watching the television, and that there was these towering infernals, and I thought, what are they doing watching that movie, Towering Infernals? But it was live, you know. It was at the New York site, and. So we adjourned the meeting, and we went back to our hotel and everything. And we were, to be honest with you, things were a little chaotic. And this is where the Crown Plaza was. It was actually even a little bit closer to the Pentagon. If we look out the window, this is what we could see. There's a situation similar to this, and there were helicopters flying around. Of course, there weren't any other planes flying around at the time. But and this just goes to show how Randy thinks. Okay, we were here at the Crown Plaza, and the National Airport was over here. But Randy had the foresight to go and walk across the highway here and go over here to the rental car place and rent a car at National Airport while all this stuff was going on. And one other story I wanted to tell you is that somebody was telling me that that Larry Bushman, Pat Porter, and Randy all walked to the Pentagon to see it, and that Randy just kind of looked at it for a while, and he just said, "There's going to be a war," and of course he was pretty right about that. So this started the trip that I had with Randy after 9/11. I was fortunate enough that Randy offered me to drive me back to Iowa. And I should just mention that the other United Airlines flight 93, we went not too far from that crash site, even though we didn't know it at the time. And so we started in Arlington, Virginia. We went to Danville, Indiana. And we drove through the night, and we took turns sleeping and everything. And I got to meet Randy's parents. We stopped there and we slept for a couple hours, and I got to meet Robert and Gloria, and I was, you know, I'm very thankful to them for their hospitality and everything. And then we went on to Ames, and then Randy dropped me off and then went on to back to Manhattan. I always kind of enjoyed that time with Randy. It was you know, it was pretty hectic time because of the United States being attacked and everything, but at the same time it was kind of a fun time to spend time with Randy and to meet his family. I really treasured that. So this special NC-205 meeting that I talked to you about before, again I went and looked at the meetings and the minute of the meetings. At the end of the meeting, the committee applauded Randy Higgins for his excellent skills in leading and conducting the meeting. This is right out of the minutes. And then Randy Higgins adjourned the meeting. So I have a, I'm going to try to do this.
Discusses pest management and transition. European corn borer, a very serious pest for corn growers, is now being managed by a variety of strategies, which are all being brought together to give a reduction in yield loss and a better economic return to growers. Those strategies involve traditional host resistance, insecticide treatments, computer strategies to help time the insecticide treatments, and then more recently BT corn, or genetically engineered resistance, which is building a new form of resistance at a very high level into the crop. I hope you'll enjoy the tape, and I'll provide you with more information on how to manage this pest. Corn producers face a number of insect pests which limit yields and lower profits in many fields.
Okay, and there's a little story about this this video. At the time, this was back in, I think, in 1997, 1998, and it was a very hectic time, and we wanted to make sure that if we educated the growers that we were saying the right thing. It was politically correct, but at the same time it was scientifically correct. So Randy was very keen on me seeing this video before he released it, because there was going to be some sort of teleconference or something. So he drove all the way from Manhattan to Ames, put it in my mailbox. Do you remember this? Well, maybe he was always doing crazy things like that. But he put it. I got up, you know, Saturday morning, and there it was. And then I was able to see it and make the comments on it and everything. But it just shows you, you know, what Randy would do for his dedication. And you know, he'd drive 6 hours, or actually 12 hours, there and back, just to make sure that something was taken care of. So I appreciate that. I'm glad you're here, Mary, that you can see that how much we really do appreciate and how much impact Randy has had on all of us. So thank you.